Just driving in here, I was looking at a book by Keith Ward, who is a prominent theistic philosopher called Why God Almost Certainly Exists. The title of the book is based on the fourth chapter of a book by Richard Dawkins called The God Delusion. The fourth chapter of that book is called Why God Almost Certainly Does Not Exist. So Keith Ward brought out a book called Why God Does Exist. This argument has been going on for generations and probably will continue. Richard Dawkins seems to think that by science we have shown that there's no need to believe in any God. But we see that there are many persons like yourselves who were raised with what is called a scientific education, who are intelligent, lucid, but who, despite what we can call the propaganda for atheism or non-spiritualism, just inherently you can feel that there's more to existence than simply chemicals. Just like you talk about, you feel the forest to be spiritual. There's more to it than just chemicals there. I suppose that in your practice of yoga, you can also feel the underlying spiritual currents, which are the real purpose of that. People think that yoga means that you just do some exercise to get healthy, but there's a lot more to it than that. I introduce myself as studying Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita, have you all heard of Bhagavad Gita, by the way? Yeah, some of you have heard. Sometimes it's called the Bible of Hinduism, which gives some idea, but it's really a misnomer, because one thing, Hinduism is a relatively modernly coined term, and the Bhagavad Gita is not so much a book of saying, well, believe it or burn, but it's a book of understanding, a book of knowledge. It's called Yoga Shastra. Means Shastra is also interpreted as scripture, but it's difficult because the words don't really translate. Yoga. Bhagavad Gita discusses yoga. Karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, and bhakti yoga. These are technical terms. The kind of yoga that is popular in the West of exercises, that is part of Ashtanga yoga, which is part of jnana yoga or dhyana yoga. Jnana means knowledge, dhyana means meditation, kara means action, and bhakti yoga means devotion. Yoga means to link. We're talking about being holistic, this holistic healing. Yoga means to link with the Supreme Spirit. That's the, if you want to boil it down to a few words, that is the ultimate purpose of yoga. To understand what is actually spiritual, we can feel inherently that if we go beyond all this idea that we are just a bunch of chemicals, if we're somewhat sensitive to spiritual reality, then it doesn't matter how much anyone argues that we are just chemicals. We know we're not. We're more than chemicals. I'm not a bunch of chemicals, nor are you. That's good news, isn't it? Chemicals have no life, and there's nothing you can do to give life to chemicals. We are spirit. But what does that mean, spirit? The term spirit is commonly used, spiritualism, spirituality. Bhagavad Gita is a book of knowledge which teaches us what is spirit and what is linking with spirit and why we need to do so. Just like Michael here was saying that it's criminal that this is not taught, because it's such valuable knowledge. Well, maybe we could say that it's not only criminal to not teach the knowledge of how to keep the body healthy, but it's practically criminal that there is no knowledge in how to understand who we actually are and how we can be healthy in all respects. The present Western culture is based on the idea that, well, we're just here once and make the most of it. And people are not satisfied with that. It's, where does this satisfaction comes from? What? It's not really very well thought out at all. Most people, they just go along with the crowd, isn't it? You go to school, you get some money, and then you drink some booze, and you go on with life like that. And no one really thinks about what they're doing, or why we're here, where we're going, what's it all. Who am I, actually? If I ask, who am I, what would we reply? We would say, my name is Michael Starkey, and I'm X number of years old. I'm a citizen of the United Kingdom. But that identity, it's changing all the time, isn't it? If we take you probably have photos of you from 20 years ago, and a lot longer, yeah. And if you had been doing yoga from the age of 5 or whatever, you'd probably be younger looking now. But there's nothing that can stop the body aging, ultimately. There are yogis in India who live for hundreds of years, and you can't really tell how old they are. I've seen that. You can see their bodies look young, but from their eyes you can see and you can see their hair goes down to the ground and beyond. So that knowledge of yoga can help to keep the body healthy, but ultimately yoga is meant for understanding who we are and what is the actual purpose of life. We're all ignorant of that. That's criminal, isn't it? That we should come into this world, we don't know why. From the education we receive, it's just presumed that when we die, everything's finished. But we can intuitively understand that there is more to existence than just chemicals. I'm more than chemicals. In the forest, it's not just some interaction of chlorophyll and sunlight and water and cells in the plants that make them grow. There's some energy there. Maybe these modern cities, they put us out of touch more with our spiritual nature, in which life is very mechanized. I just thought as I came through here, don't mind me saying this, but it's almost the architecture, it's almost would cause depression, I would think. It's so functional. There's no aestheticism, is there? Just functional. Everything's very formal and straightforward. Well, you're trying to get around that by holistic treatment and horticulture, therapy, and so many things. But life is very stereotyped. So what is this yoga? It begins with knowledge of the spirit. When we say knowledge, generally people think, well, it's just a belief. But actually, there is knowledge of what is spirit. Generally, we think of knowledge as something we can calculate and ascertain. We know that acids reacted with alkalis form salt and water. It's something demonstrable. But what is spirit? Where is it? We can't catch it. We can't see it. We can't find it in a microscope. We can't find it in a telescope. We can't find it in any kind of scope. There are so many kinds of scopes. But to presume that it doesn't exist because of that is very limiting in our capacity to understand what is actual knowledge. The idea that knowledge of everything must be something that we can measure, that's called materialism. But materialism doesn't satisfy the soul. What is the soul? That is explained in Bhagavad Gita. It's a book of spiritual knowledge. The fact that we can't measure it in terms of length, breadth, height, weight, decibels, or whatever, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We can experience, we can understand, we can intuit that we are spiritual beings. What exactly does that mean? So that is explained in Bhagavad Gita, which I say is the basis of India's spiritual culture. It's only 700 verses, actually. It's quite short. So that is explained therein that what are we? We are body, mind, and soul. That's the general understanding, isn't it? But Bhagavad Gita teaches us that we are only the soul. That we are not the body. This body is temporary, and I presently identify with the body and the mind, but actually I am soul. I am not a body with a soul. I am a soul that is covered by a body and a mind. And with each body that we get as we go from body to body, because we are eternal and the body is temporary, we identify with that body. And because of identifying with that body, we forget that we're a soul. And because via the body we want to enjoy this world, then we come back again and again and again. But actually, that means we're born again and again and again, because we have desires that we want to enjoy this world. But our actual nature is not to be in this world, because this world is a place of suffering ultimately. We all have to die, we all have to suffer disease, we all have to suffer old age, we all have to suffer being reborn, and the confusion that goes with that. So our real spiritual nature is that we are eternal beings. We're not meant to die, we're not meant to grow old, we're not meant to get sick. We don't want any of these things. Anyone disagree with that? Anyone want to die? No, obviously. Well, some people do. That's why there's suicide. But that's out of frustration. No one inherently wants to non-exist. So we're eternal beings, and we come into different bodies, one after the other, one after the other, one after the other, with many, many desires which we try to fulfill. But this material world is not actually a place that we can be happy in. It's a foreign existence to us. There is a spiritual world where everything is eternal, everything is happy, there's no suffering, and we are meant for going there. Now, we are all spiritual living beings. We're very, very small. That's a very good thing to understand, that we're very small. Because often we're trying to make ourselves bigger than we actually are, but we're very, very small. If we consider just this present birth, it's just a blip in time. And where are we? We're in Nottingham, in England, on the planet Earth, which is just a speck in a massive universe. So we're just very tiny being in a huge universe. We're very, very small. But that doesn't mean we're not important. Everyone is important. Every living being is important. Not only humans, animals, plants. Every living being is important. Because every living being means there's consciousness. That is the symptom of the soul. There's no consciousness in, for instance, this microphone. But there's consciousness in every living being. Even in the plants, there's consciousness. Right? What do you think? Yeah. In the plants, in the rivers, in the wind, in everything there's consciousness. Our nature is that we are conscious living beings, and with consciousness comes desire, the desire to be happy. And what is that happiness? What is the ultimate happiness? The ultimate happiness is to attain our complete holistic state. That means we relate with all other living beings in an atmosphere of love. Love is the highest happiness. Love means giving, not taking. In this world, we want to be happy by taking, by exploiting others, or by putting ourselves in the center. But love means to subordinate our own desires for the happiness of others. And those who do so, they experience happiness, the happiness of selflessness. Bhakti yoga means the yoga of devotion. Devotion specifically to Krishna. Krishna is that person who is known in the English language as God. That's the closest description. It means the supreme controller. But the understanding of Krishna is not so much as the supreme controller as the supreme object of love, the supreme spirit, the spirit who gives life to all other spirits, and by relating with whom, by linking with whom in yoga, we become fully satisfied. Krishna is the supreme person. When we talk of love, love is for persons. We can have a general sense of love for everyone and the universe, but ultimately love is for a person. And the happiness that we seek in various ways. Yesterday I was in Sheffield and I asked the people I was speaking to, so what is there that can give you happiness in Sheffield? One of the persons present said, when Sheffield United win. That's one kind of happiness. It's not a very high standard of happiness. I also suggested, not that I follow the football scores, that they probably lose more than they win. And this whole idea of being happy by following a football team, there are 20 odd teams in the league and only one of them wins and all the rest are lamenting. So it's more likely to create unhappiness. So there is happiness, the happiness of having the football team that you identify with, although actually we have no intrinsic relation. Just because we think, I support Sheffield United, and we identify with it, and we get some happiness if they win their game, whatever that means, because football is also arbitrary. Someone decided some rules, and when you put the ball there, it's a goal, but it has no actual meaning. It's just something someone made up at some point in time. So there's that kind of happiness. There's the happiness of bringing a baby into this world. You've done many births. You do deliveries also. Were you there at the delivery?
No, I think my mother went to the hospital. We used to. We don't anymore.
That's one kind of happiness. That's a miracle, isn't it? Seeing a baby come into the world. There's the happiness of getting drunk. It's also one kind of happiness. I don't recommend it, it's not a very high, but there must be something in it, otherwise people wouldn't do it. So there is happiness in all these things. Yeah, there are various levels of happiness. There's some people find happiness in giving misery to others. It's also one kind of happiness. I also don't recommend that. Some people find happiness in giving happiness to others. That's better. But the highest happiness is found in relationship with Krishna, who is the reservoir of all love and happiness. That's what we're looking for. When someone drinks a bottle of wine, they don't know it, but they're looking for Krishna. When we walk in the country and the crisp air, and we feel rejuvenated, and ultimately we're looking for Krishna. When we find the pleasure that comes from having a body that is healthy and vigorous, that pleasure that we feel, that is a reflection of the supreme bliss that we find in relationship to Krishna. So everyone's looking for Krishna, the happiness of pure love of Krishna that comes from selfless service to Krishna. Krishna doesn't need our service, but we become happy by serving Him. So everyone's looking for that, but in this world, whatever happiness we get is inevitably mixed with distress. It's unavoidable. As the person who gets drunk finds out, and of course they knew that even before they got drunk, but not knowing that, not knowing anything better, they go for that. It's as you were saying, it's criminal. It's sad that you're saying it's criminal that this knowledge of yoga is not taught. It's sad that one of the main features of the British way of life, I was going to say culture, but maybe lifestyle is a bit more accurate term, is that people think that happiness can be found in a bottle of wine or beer or whatever. It's a very low standard of happiness. Low, I mean, in the sense that it's not at all fulfilling. It doesn't come anywhere near to satisfying the soul. Certainly, practicing yoga, doing horticulture, forestry, that's closer to the soul than getting drunk. To get closest to the soul, we have to link in yoga with the source of all spirituality, who is Krishna. There's a very easy way to do that, actually. It's very easy to have bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion, simply by chanting the names of Krishna, understanding that we are linked with Krishna. There are many, many ways we can serve Krishna. The perfection of your gardening will be to take the flowers and the fruit and the vegetables and offer them to Krishna. That brings it all through to fruition. That first of all, you select the land if you have that much freedom to do so. What is good land for gardening? And then you see what is the right season, what crops we can, what, how we can make, whatever kind of gardening you're doing, permaculture, whatever. And then doing whatever's required. You may need to put straw on certain plants in January or whatever. Giving the right amount of water if necessary, if there's not enough from the clouds. Doing it very carefully, overseeing and seeing this living being emerge, a miracle every time, from seeds or bulbs or saplings, and just seeing that living being emerge, and then giving, the plants are giving. They give their fruit, a lot of the plants that they're also technically fruits, aren't they? Like courgettes and tomatoes and cucumbers. So we take that, they're giving that, and we offer it to Krishna. And then we take what Krishna gives back to us. And we feel fully satisfied, and even the plant, the soul that is in the body of the plant, becomes benefited by our doing so. So this is the perfection of horticulture. To grow the fruit and flower, everything, thinking that, let us offer this to Krishna. And that completely spiritualizes the act of gardening, that we offer everything to Krishna. In the forest also, we can think how to make a nice forest, and then we will bring Krishna here to see the forest. Krishna's one name is Kunja Bihari. It means he who likes to wander within the forests. It's a very well-known name of Krishna. He likes the forests. Mostly lands, fertile lands, if they're not civilized by humans, they're forests. Naturally the land becomes, if the land is fertile and there's sufficient water, then naturally the lands will be covered by forests. So the forest cover of the world was much more until fairly recently. This would have all been forest land until fairly recently. It means in the last maybe few hundred years, then it became farmland and then it became Nottingham City. We see that in India now with the mass urbanization. We can see whole areas of towns, and you can see it's all new and there are still fields all around where people are still cultivating. But you know those fields are doomed because they'll also come under concrete very soon. So yeah, this is the perfection of spiritual understanding, is to first of all understand who we are. We're eternal living beings. We're meant for full happiness, full bliss, full beauty, full love. That is possible in relationship to Krishna. The perfection of yoga is not simply to keep the body fit, although we certainly shouldn't abuse the body, we should try to keep it fit, but keep the body fit for the purpose of spiritual realization, because it's only in the human body that we have sufficiently developed consciousness to even consider these matters. Anyway, there's a short introduction, a few points there. There are many, many things to discuss. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that someone might understand all these things after many, many lifetimes. Our journey has to begin somewhere. So would anyone like to offer anything? Any question? Comment? Spiritual yoga, fully spiritual.
For some of us householders, like myself, who was not involved in any kind of horticulture, we have deities, we do offering, we chant. What else can we actually do to practice?
What more can we do to practice yoga than what we're doing? We can intensify what we're doing. I often suggest to persons of your age, I don't know exactly what your age is, but I would suspect that you've had kids and they're grown up.
Yes.
Time to retire and just devote yourself fully to spiritual practices.
Yes.
There's no need to go on all your life working, working, and then retiring and not knowing what to do. Once your family responsibilities are finished, then you can just do full-time bhakti yoga, either here in England or you could go to Vrindavan or whatever. It's the last spurt at the end of life. Prepare yourself for leaving this body and going to the spiritual world. Otherwise, going on and on and on, working all your life. What's the point? We have to purify our consciousness. Oh, one thing I should mention is that I'm involved in several projects where we're developing communities where people can come and live with their families, grow our own food, live very simply, no electricity, for instance, and chant Hare Krishna and be happy. And they are actually very happy. These are mostly people who are coming from what are called good jobs. In India, there's still a lot of difference between people who are well-educated and earning money and a lot of people who are very poor. So these are people who've gone through their schooling, earning significantly above the average, who thought that for their spiritual life and for the spiritual life of their children, they need to make some major adjustments in their life. So they've establishing communities where they can raise their children in a spiritual atmosphere away from the highly materialistic ethos in the cities in India today. And what happiness they get. Recently, well, it wasn't so recently now, but actually shortly after one of these communities was established, I visited one of them after several months of moving around and around and around, and I came. And it was the first time I'd visited since this one couple who are young couple, they're about 30 years old, they were instrumental in establishing this community. So I'd just been there at the time they established it, and then I came back again some months later. So the first thing I said to them is that your faces have become brighter and darker, both. Because in India, if you're outside a lot of the time, especially, and then your skin will become quite darker. Even though Indian people, their skin is somewhat dark, but with a lot of exposure. So I said, your face has become much darker and it's become much brighter. That means their face is shining with happiness. And they said, yes, we're so happy here. We're so happy. It's very peaceful and we can live with all devotees, spiritually minded people, and grow our own food. Naturally, there's no electricity, so the sun sets around 6:30 in that part of India throughout the year, pretty much. So they go to sleep by 8:30. They wake up automatically early in the morning. Early in the morning is the best time for spiritual life. Even this morning in Sheffield, when I woke up, it was about just before 4 o'clock, something like that. And already there was a bird singing, still in the city, next to the river, Sheaf. So morning time and everything is so peaceful, just perfect for spiritual practices and living with spiritually minded people. They became so happy by doing that. It's not actually very difficult to be happy in this world, but people, they have no idea. They're trying to get happiness by getting possessions and pursuing some ideal of romance, which doesn't exist actually in the world, is mostly in the imagination. And no idea actually how to live just peaceful, happy life. So I'm involved with some communities in which devotees of Krishna, they're moving away from the cities and just living like this, growing their own food. They're so happy to grow their own food and offer it to Krishna. And they become amazed how How on a little piece of land you can, so much food will come up. And how you don't need insecticides and chemicals of any kind. The best, generally the best fertilizer is the cow urine and cow dung. Excellent fertilizer. Yeah, so, anything else? Anyone like to say? If not, then Hare Krishna to you all. You have some prasadam for them all? Would you like to say something yourselves? Anything more?
I can say a little more. I'm smiling because we went to the city farm and collected bags of dung, and so the land in front of the surgery was dug over, so arranged a dig-a-thon, and we dug the dung into the ground.
So which kind of dung was that?
There was cow kind of dung in it, but
it's mixed dung. Yeah.
Horses.
Yeah, I remember as a kid, going to school. I was living in a village in Buckinghamshire, I think it's in Berkshire now, near Slough, and every day as we go past, there's this terrible smell. I think that was pig dung it's from the fields. But cow dung doesn't smell bad like that, or horse dung doesn't smell bad. I'm sure even the pig dung must be good fertilizer, otherwise they wouldn't put it on the fields. Human dung is also good. Make it into slurry. Everything can be recycled. All these natural things. It's the natural thing. Sometimes in India the septic tanks aren't made very well, and around the area you find the plants just shoot up where it's leaking. Septic tank. You don't have that much here, do you? You have a... In the country. No, I mean like the individual septic tanks for each house. They still have that? In the villages, yeah. Where there's no... Yeah.
Here we have Stoke Bardolph, which is a big...
It's a sewage. Sewage works. Yeah.
Cycled and put on the fields, crops are grown.
Oh, that's allowed, are they, to put human dung? I think at one time it was banned or something. But it has to be broken down first.
And he was saying with growing population that we really have no choice but to use our ways to fertilize land, because soil is so depleted of resources because we just drain and drain with intensive farming. So he was sort of singing the praises of our dung to fertilize our fields.
As we somehow, well, I introduced it, we got onto this not very exalted topic of human feces. One interesting point is that from the public toilets you can understand the difference between the vegetarian and non-vegetarians, because the non-vegetarian stuff smells a lot worse. What do you think, doctor? Too much protein in there? A lot of in meat there are a lot of poisons. a lot of poisons in meat. Especially the stuff which is produced from factory farms, from torturing animals and then killing them. So that's an important part of culture, isn't it? That we're talking about holistic living and developing finer sentiments, spiritual sentiments. Well, that should begin with not killing animals. And people say, well, what about the plants? You're killing them also. Well, a lot of vegetarian food doesn't involve killing at all. When you take a fruit from a tree, you don't kill it. When you harvest grains, the grains are already dead in the sense that they're ripe. When you take milk from cows, you don't kill the cow. Some plants are killed, but we have to offer it to Krishna because we can't avoid killing something. But clearly the consciousness of a potato is less than that of a cow. So the karmic reaction that comes for killing a potato is not nearly as severe as that from killing an animal, which clearly strongly suffers, feels pain. We feel pain. The animals also feel pain, so we shouldn't unnecessarily give pain to others. That's a most basic spiritual and ethical principle. Sometimes you may not be able to avoid it. The doctors give pain all the time. They're always slashing people with knives. Well, I presume you use anesthetics before you do so. But even that, if it's an injection, can be painful. So sometimes you can't avoid it. But to unnecessarily give pain to others, that means there has to be some negative karmic reaction coming. Right? Mm-hmm. For every action, there is a reaction. At the karmic level also. People should be taught that. What do you think? That's an important... That's very important. That you can't get away with it. You might avoid the law. You might get through life without being caught by the police, or you might just be such a big shot that you get away with all the crimes you do, like News of the World and all this kind of thing. But there's the laws of God, the laws of the universe. We should know that. Anything else, or we should wind up here?
Lust is a broken
intelligence. Just I was talking with Sankirtan before, yeah. That's from the, I was talking about the Bhagavad Gita verse. I was thinking of the Bhagavad Gita verse, which fits with the whole idea of holistic therapy, that Indriyani Parani Ahur Indri Parang Manaha Manasas Tu Para Buddhir Yo Buddhe Paratastu Saha, in which Krishna says that there are senses. Above the senses is the mind, above the mind is the intelligence, and above the intelligence is the soul. And I just said to Sankirtan Prabhu that Ramanuja, one of the great spiritual leaders of India, he interprets that differently to say that above the intelligence is lust. Because in the context of the verses that are being there, it's a discussion of lust. So so that fits, because Krishna doesn't exactly say soul, he says saha, which means that or it or he. So it can be interpreted. So what it means in this relation, that lust or material desire, when we become separated, when we from our spiritual existence, then lust dominates our senses, our body, our mind, our intelligence. We become overcome by material desire and we forget that we're spiritual living beings. So that's another way to understand that verse. Actually, the highest is the soul, but because we are a yoga, we're not linked in yoga, viyoga, subtraction, then we are dominated by material desire. We're pushed around in this material world by desire. We think I'm in control, but actually we're being pulled like dogs on a leash by desire. Anyone? Anything else?
I think that question and the verse Maharaj said brings us very nicely to our original topic, which was how Bhakti Yoga is an essential part of all yoga to be able to find ourselves to an understanding of where we can be happy, or we can really start to think about exactly what it means to be well. As a physician for many years, when I reached 50, then I had worked here for many, many years already, and I was given time to take a sabbatical leave, and I came to the Mindful Institute of Higher Educational Studies to learn with others from internationally, coming to this center to focus on understanding more what exactly it means to understand the soul or to understand myself. And all the people here are far away from a community in India where they can retreat to a quieter, more peaceful existence, because you know everybody here is having to do every day what they have to do, or at least for some more years, and then they may do different things. I hope we will all go to greener pastures. However, as we carry on every day, then this Bhakti Yoga is so beautiful that we can actually bring it to where we are in terms of what you said about chanting, how it started, and offering our produce from the land or what we buy from the shops to Krishna before we partake of it ourselves. So as you said, you know, it is a simple process, and it brings in consciousness which is higher day by day, which makes us happier if we engage in that process.
Yeah, yeah, it can be done. It can be done anywhere. You don't have to go to a farm in India. But the farms could be done in England also. It's not that farming is a monopoly of India. Obviously not.
So I would like to thank you very much for coming to this group here and giving us your valuable time and your instructions and your wisdom. Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.